This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're going to talk about the week's news, and you can join us at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can always call us at 860-275-7266. Colin McEnroe is out again this week, but we're thrilled to have some really great guests in studio to talk with us about the week's news, including Bilal Sakhu, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford. Welcome back to the show, Bilal.
Hey, thank you.
Also with us is Max Reese. He's political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Hello once again, Max.
Good morning, John.
And Susan Bigelow, a contributor to ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Susan.
Good morning.
Well, we're going to start in Washington, or maybe Helsinki. We don't often start there because there's so much state news, but we're going to try to connect what happened this week in Helsinki to what's happening at the state level. Donald Trump, as you may have heard, had a summit with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. They talked behind closed doors for a couple hours. We're probably never going to know what exactly was said. What was said afterward at a press conference has, well, set everyone kind of a twitter. Trump just yesterday walked back some of his comments, but he did face an awful lot of criticism over the course of the last couple days from official Washington, from people who used to work in the White House in the past, including Richard Clark. He's a counterterrorism expert. He'd worked for Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He was on CNN trying to make sense of Trump's inability to stand up to his Russian counterpart.
I have been very reluctant to come to the conclusion that he's a controlled asset. That's the term that we use in the intelligence community when we have someone in another government who, for whatever reason, does what we want them to do, because we're bribing them, because we have something on them. He is acting like a controlled asset.
All right. That's one opinion, but we've heard several opinions like that. John McCain didn't say that, but John McCain said it was one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. Before we get to some of what we've heard from state Republicans and others around Connecticut, Bilal, I'll just ask you, what do you make of President Trump walking back some of his statements saying, well, what I actually meant to say is I do trust our intelligence operations, and I think Russia may have been involved?
Well, my first reaction was really to laugh out loud. I mean, I thought it was quite hysterical the way in which he did that. The difference between wouldn't brought me back to the Clinton years about ears. And it was an astonishing moment to watch the president stand next to Putin in Helsinki and essentially throw under the bus the entire intelligence community. It received condemnation from across the aisle, both Democrats, Republicans condemned him, former national security folks and Defense Department folks. I mean, and so it was pretty loud that what he did, many people found quite objectionable, and it raised real questions about what does Putin have on him that would make him behave this way? And I think it made that issue for him and the difficulty around that even worse than it was going into Helsinki. And so it was not a proud moment for America, not a proud moment for the American people, and certainly one of the most difficult moments of his presidency, I think.
I think at the very least you expect the president of the United States to stand up for the United States, and he didn't do that. You know, I don't know if I don't know what was quite going through his head, but I think a quick look at perhaps Hugh Grant's role in Love Actually may have been helpful. You know, you don't need to necessarily be that incredible aggressive. You could say something, anything that says, I'm standing up for the U.S., I'm standing up for the intelligence community. And something that kind of struck me was, even for many of the apologists of the president, the people who would say, you know, frankly, Sean Hannity, et cetera, who'd say, whatever the president says, that is what should go. Even they were kind of contorting themselves in a new way, saying like, well, yes, there may have been Russian involvement, but no, there wasn't collusion, and that has nothing to do with the president. Therefore, the way the president said this, that makes it okay, which is a long and frankly completely not believable explanation.
Because I think, Susan, one could say, if you were inclined to believe or support the president, you could say, I believe my intelligence community that Russia was involved, and I'm here to talk with Vladimir Putin about this. However, there's been no proof yet of any sort of collusion, and you won't find any proof because I and my campaign did not collude. It's what's unusual about this entire
that
thing is
so reasoned.
Yeah,
that,
that's not what was said, though, was it?
That sounds like someone actually defending a position that one could imagine coming out of someone's mouth. What actually did come out of someone's mouth was shocking, and it was a little bit unusual. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it.
Neither have I. And I take this in the context of his entire foreign trip. If we look at how he treated his NATO allies at the NATO summit just previously, the contrast is alarming. One of the major goals of Russian foreign policy is to weaken the large institutions that are to its west, NATO and the European Union. And Donald Trump is doing both of those things very well. He is sort of trying to almost like extort money out of our NATO allies to get them to pay more money for defense. He's trying like he's pushing the Brexit buttons very hard in Britain, and that undermines the EU. He's undermining Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, and then getting so cozy and comfortable with Vladimir Putin. It's so dangerous. It's so dangerous because NATO is one of these things that undergirds world security. And to see that alliance in any kind of trouble is very, very dangerous thing indeed. And it's very good for Russia, but very bad for the U.S.
The only comparison we have for these kinds of events is what other presidents have done and the way all those events have been handled. And we currently have a president who's made it very clear that he's far more interested in harboring relations with North Korea and with Russia and getting cozy with them than with our historical allies, Germany, the United Kingdom, Italy, France, all of these other developed nations. They are just not his priority. But these nations that may perhaps have dictatorships, murderous individuals running the countries are the ones that Donald Trump appears to feel much more comfortable with.
He looks up to them, which is very worrisome.
What's amazing to me, though, is that Donald Trump is really consistent. I mean, if you really think about it, these have been positions he's taken mm-hmm. for many years. He has been hostile to many of these international trade agreements. He's complained about the EU. And what strikes me about the way in which people responded with such shock about what he said in Helsinki is that he has been saying this for years, right? Since the election, he has denied that Russia meddled in the election, and he has denied that there was collusion. He certainly has conflated the two issues of collusion and meddling to suggest that they are the same. He can't acknowledge one without acknowledging the other and seeing that they're linked. What was stunning to me is that his aides and advisors tried to get him to do something different. And his unwillingness to do that is a reflection of just his personality. He doubles down. He lies. He sort of adds on another lie to cover up the previous lie. And what's really astonishing is that the very next day, this sort of play with words between Wood and Wooden. And
to double negative.
Exactly. And to have Republican leaders then come out one day later after condemning him, 24 hours later to come out and say, oh, I'm glad he cleared that up. That is just an amazing moment in our political system.
Well, and I just want to quickly say, when we talk about things that take a lot of guts, standing up and asking questions at a press conference is pretty low on the list. Max, you and I have been in that world an awful lot. But I will say that the Reuters reporter, the Associated Press reporter, who stood up and asked questions directly of Vladimir Putin about the indictments, the 12 indictments that came down the previous year, looking in the face of someone who has had people killed, a number of journalists around the world killed, that takes a little something. And I think to Bilal's point of President Trump being consistent, I think the one thing that has put a little bit of a chink in the armor and in the base, certainly around these last couple of days, is there's one thing he wasn't consistent with in the last few days, is that he always appears to be strong even when he's in a weak position. And that's something he's remarkably good at. He always comes out as the guy who is in charge of things. And this felt like a weak place to be because, in part, you've got a Reuters reporter standing up there and saying, President Putin, did you meddle with our elections? And the president of the United States was unable to do that.
It's almost as if he was completely comfortable acceding to a brutal dictator, as if to say, yes, I believe everything he said. And you know what? He's an okay guy in my book, which he, by the way, kind of said is the way. I can't believe I said that in that way. But we've never seen a president in that way with this kind of person. I'm trying to think through the Obama years. I suppose his attempts with Cuba were probably the closest we had to this. Correct me if I'm wrong, anybody here, where attempting to normalize relations with Cuba when you had many people saying, how can you normalize relations with this kind of a dictator and this kind of a family? But I think most people would agree, and experts on this, Russia is very different in the modern age than Cuba perhaps ever was.
Yeah, and his body language, Trump's body language during the entire thing,
yeah.
He was deferential. He was sort of – he was almost cowed. He was – somebody said this, that he usually like tries to be the alpha male, and he was very much a beta in this situation, and it was weird. It was out of character for him to see him so sort of demure almost. It was weird.
So I want to turn to how any of this affects state politics. Obviously, all of us have been thinking about this over the course of the last couple of days. It's the biggest issue at play in the world right now. But it does trickle down to what's happening at the state level. And Max, I'll just go to you first. I know the Hartford Courant was trying to find out from Republicans in the governor's race what they think about President Trump's performance. David Stemmerman seems to be the only person with anything approaching a denouncement of Trump. Have you heard anything from the leading Republicans who are vying for the top office in the state?
There's been radio silence from the entire governor's field, if you will. We talk with these candidates in campaigns all the time. Nothing really from them. And they've been, you know, they've had a couple of events this week, and we're going to talk about those a little bit later. But they need to come up with ways to stay cozy with the base and know that those Trump supporters, the diehards, where Trump can say the sky is green and they're going to believe him, that they're going to come out to the polls and they're going to vote for them. So they are in a – they need to toe this very fine line where none of them can really come out and say, I cannot believe that the President of the United States did not stand up for our intelligence community.
And this, Bilal, is I think where international politics play at the local level, because if you have a president who in the minds of many Republicans in the state did in his one big legislative accomplishment – cut taxes for an awful lot of them. And that's something that many people were feeling they could go to the polls with. It's why you might cozy up to a Donald Trump. Then you have this other thing on the other side. Here's what's happening with the Russia investigation. Here's what's happening with these trips abroad, how he deals with NATO, how he deals with Canada, how he deals with Russia. Do these things actually matter to the voter who's voting at the state level about things like, I don't know, how to hire my taxes?
Right. I'm a believer in the idea that all politics is local. And in that sense, that people really do care about what their taxes are in the state, what the economic situation in the state is in terms of job growth and job creation. But to the extent that these things are linked at the national level, and certainly one of the things that Trump has tried to project is this idea that he has helped sort of usher in this great sort of economic recovery in the United States that really, I guess, from his perspective, started when he took office, and that the economy hadn't been turning around before that. And so to the extent that voters make that connection, you know, Republicans can benefit at the local level if they see things that way. I think the larger problem they have, and I think Max alluded to this, is that this base of the party is quite rabid for this president. And so at the end of the day, when you speak out against this president, you potentially jeopardize what 25% to 30% of your support. And when you're running in a state where elections can be quite close, that could mean death for your campaign. And so people are afraid in the Republican Party and won't challenge this president because of that.
And we keep reminding people that if we're talking about a Republican primary in the middle of August, we're talking about maybe 100,000 people if everyone gets excited about it coming out to vote.
And if I could add one more thing, not just in Connecticut, but I mean, take Connecticut, wherever your Republican primary voter is going to be, but then extrapolate that out a little bit to swing Senate seats in the United States, Montana, Missouri, Indiana, possibly Arizona. There's not a single voter in any of those places that I just mentioned, I don't think, where I agree with Bilal, who's going to turn on Donald Trump because of the Russia comments specifically. It's just that's just not going to happen. They're going to be thinking more about the taxes that you mentioned. The idea of Russia, while that might be problematic to them, I don't think that that's going to be a single issue voter issue for any of them.
It's not, Susan, but okay, so we've got a primary. Every, especially on the Republican side, every primary is this interesting tightrope, as Max said, where you've got to appeal to a base, you've got to appeal to the very small percentage of Republicans who are going to come out in August anyway to vote. But then you've got to go run a general election in Connecticut, where almost all of the stuff that is red meat for the Trump voter isn't going to turn out an awful lot of unaffiliated and Democrats to your side. And so what do you do if you're, you know, Bob Stefanowski or Mark Boughton or any of these other guys in terms of how you think about Trump and how he works for you or not?
Well, you try to mention him as little as possible, except when you're cornered and you have to. They all will give him an A grade when they're asked. He's great. We like him. He's great. But they're not going to necessarily go out there and stand up for him unbidden. But the problem is that this really does show the Trumpification of the Republican Party. And even in Connecticut here, where we're supposedly we have a lot of moderate Republicans, there are very few Republicans at this point who haven't sort of broken with the party who are anti-Trump. The anti-Trump people are not necessarily still there. If they are there, they're not saying anything because life can be made very difficult. If you're a Republican who's anti-Trump, other Republicans are going to make your life difficult and you're not going to be very happy about things. So, yeah.
Well, what Susan was referencing is at the debate being the most recent GOP debate being asked about what grade you'd give the president. They all say A, max. I mean, I don't know. is that the only thing to draw from that debate as far as
I guess the interesting thing about that debate was you had Bob Stefanowski on the stage with the group for the first time. And Bob Stefanowski's essentially running what I would best describe as the most un-Connecticut Connecticut campaign going, essentially ignoring all party norms, all inter-party squabbling and machine politics to go right to the people. But back to the Trump element to this, the great unknown, if you will, about this governor's race, but all the statewides, is there an anti-Trump factor that could wash away the idea of Republican gains? Like, is that something that's quiet, that's maybe below the surface, that we saw bubble up in places like Farmington, Greenwich, and Glastonbury during local elections where Democrats just wanted to go out to the polls? Republicans could be shaking a bush here if they really embrace Trump between now and the primary, and then they start to distance a little bit between August 15th and November 8th, if you will.
Yeah, you follow local towns pretty closely, Susan. You see that?
I think it's going to be I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily going to be a thing unless the blue wave, if it does exist, is huge. I think it depends on how big a margin that's going to be. I do think Connecticut voters will split their votes. I think that Connecticut voters are very comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to see a lot of just straight party line voters come out unless there's a huge Democratic turnout. That is a possibility for swinging something like the governor's race.
Yeah. Wow. Just great analysis there. I don't know that I can add much more, but I'm not really sure that how Trump will actually play in the state. I think the state has a number of challenges in front of it that anyone who wants that job, and I'm still amazed that anyone wants that job, but, you know, the challenges in front of the state with regard to, you know, the issues around taxes in the state, around jobs and job growth and job creation, housing affordability, and the long list of other challenges, to me, suggests that, you know, those candidates have a lot to deal with just about state-based issues as opposed to thinking about what's going on in Helsinki. And I think voters will be, you know, laser focused on those kinds of issues and who can help this state recover.
Well, so there's Trump hanging over the entire Republican Party, whether or not he's a positive or a negative. Then there's how some of the issues that Trump and his base espouse may or may not play in Connecticut. But then there's another thing that happened at this most recent debate, Bilal. Mark Boughton, who is the endorsed party candidate, he's been on the statewide stage more than the others who are in this race right now with him. He referenced the Hartford Courant as fake news in response to David Stemmerman citing a current editorial labeling Boughton's income tax phase-out plan as pie in the sky, basically making the point, what can you believe in the Hartford Courant? Fake news. This is somebody who hasn't necessarily aligned himself very closely with Trump over the course of the last several years, although some of his previous positions on immigration may indeed line up very much with Donald Trump and his administration. Using the fake news term in a way that's a little bit of a dog whistle for many people, and I'm not sure how well that plays in Connecticut.
Right. You know, quite troubling to me for a number of reasons. You know, just doing this show and being around a lot of people, I also sit on the board of the Connecticut Mirror, and so I work with a lot of journalists, you know, in the state, just a great staff with the Mirror. And this is a troubling dimension of our sort of body politic right now, where the media is under attack by the president and to see politicians. This is a global problem. You know, people around the world are describing journalists as writing fake news and creating hostility towards journalism. Mainstream journalism is really struggling with, you know, what's happened with changes in social media and advertising dollars going to support newspapers. And so a lot of stuff has shifted online. A lot of reporters have lost their jobs. And so to have politicians attacking the media, which to me is the sort of fourth estate of our nation, or the fourth sort of key sort of branch of our nation's government, really, in many ways, to hold politicians accountable, to inform the public. Recently, Marsha Chambers, who was a member of the Connecticut Mirror Board, passed away, and it was a great loss for us at the Mirror.
A dear friend,
and you know, and the work she did, and just an incredible asset, and someone who has done some incredible work in journalism. And so, we need more people like her, you know, who are out there doing that kind of work. And so this was really disheartening to hear him say that.
And just before, because yeah. I don't want to lose the thread that Bilal just said about Marsha Chambers. She's someone who many local readers might know from the last couple of years, the Branford Eagle, an online publication she started, a beautiful obit written by Paul Bass, and another one on the radio by Laurie Mack the other day. If you don't know about Marsha Chambers' work, I would encourage you to look it up. If you think about what reporters do, and you think about the hard work that goes into it, read about Marsha Chambers and read about what it was like to be a woman in the New York Times newsroom in the 1970s chasing down big stories when there was all sorts of sexism at work and there was all sorts of problems for her to do her job. And the ability to actually get stories out that change people's lives is remarkable. That takes guts. Parenthetically.
And this is what journalists do, yeah. And that's why to hear them under attack this way is so troubling.
Yeah.
Boughton attempted to walk back the comments saying, oh, can't you take a joke? When you read the comments in print, and even if you hear them, it just doesn't sound like a joke. It sounds like this is a guy who completely disregards the paper of record in this state as fake news. And the problem here, too, that I see is that a lot of us in the press have very good relationships with Mark Boughton. We all get along with him very, very well. He's extremely open. He responds to text messages, phone calls on his cell phone, all those things. So for him to say that, that was clearly meant to be a red meat throw to the crowd. What I'll also say is the context on this, it was referring to his nearly completely bogus attempt to get rid of the income tax. Every single candidate saying they're going to get rid of the income tax is borderline lying. I'm not going to say they're completely lying. I'm going to say borderline lying because, look, you want to do it, go right ahead. Then what you've done is you've said to everyone with a disability in this state, just about every education system and every major social program, we're going to cut you by probably 28 to 40%. Ish. And I know that Keith Faniff has been on this show many times to discuss that. That's what cutting the income tax entirely does. And this is a state with an incredibly high moral conscience. So I don't think that people are going to be okay with just cutting $9 billion of the state's $18 billion in revenue for a political talking point.
Yeah, his plan, he's tried to flesh this out, Susan. He says it's going to happen over the course of something like 10 years. Not exactly sure how that's going to be accomplished.
Yeah.
And as Keith Faniff writes in the Connecticut Mirror, his plan does not state how he would accomplish this goal in the face of the huge post-election deficits projected by nonpartisan analysis.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. If we think of tax cuts as kind of like an economic program, they cost a lot of money in lost revenue to the state. There's no way that he's going to be able to pay for any of this. None of them have any ways to actually pay for it. Yes, there probably will be some economic growth, but tax cuts alone don't solve some of the major economic problems that we have. We don't have a big city. We have aging infrastructure. We have an aging population. People are still leaving. It still costs a lot of money to live and do business here. Tax cuts don't address that. Unfortunately, that doesn't hurt him with Republican primary voters right now because they want to hear things like, we're going to get rid of taxes. And they want to hear things like, the current is fake news. It's like a walking comment section on a newspaper or online. It's not great. But that's where the Republican base is right now.
We're going to talk about some of the other get-togethers that have happened over the course of the last week, including Ned Lamont and Joe Ganim in a showdown, their first big showdown here in recent weeks. We're talking with Susan Bigelow, contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut, Bilal Sakhu, associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can always call us 860-275-7266. We're going to turn to the Democrats debating in just a moment with Bilal Sakhu from the University of Hartford, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Max Reese from NBC Connecticut. You will notice that Colin McEnroe is out again this week. He'll be back very, very soon. The cameras of CTN are with us today. I do want to just give a little programming note that Where We Live is going to be talking with a lot more of these candidates. I want you to write these down because I know that you'll want to hear all of them in their entirety. But on the 24th of July, Steve Obsitnik will be in. Mark Boughton will be in on July 26th. He can answer questions about fake news. On Friday, July 27th, 5th District Congressional race, the GOP candidates will be in. Joe Ganim's coming in on July 30th. Tim Herbst on July 31st. You can look back on our website, WNPR.org, to see Lucy's recent interview with Ned Lamont. All sorts of good stuff on Where We Live coming up. So the same night that the Republicans were debating at Mohegan Sun, two remaining Democratic gubernatorial contenders, Joe Ganim and Ned Lamont, squared off in New Haven. On last week's show, we wondered if Lamont would bring up Ganim's 2003 corruption conviction. Ganim has set out to score points among urban voters by saying he, like other ex-convicts, is deserving of a second chance. At their debate, Lamont insisted Ganim has already gotten his second chance. Bridgeport voters returned him to the mayor's office, and that Ganim is now repaying them by running for governor before his current mayoral term is up. Here's Lamont trying to bring his point home.
They gave you a second chance. Now fight for them. Complete your term. Turn around Bridgeport. I would like, as your governor, work with you every day to make Bridgeport an incredible success.
Okay, so Ned Lamont trying to hit back at Joe Ganim, and that's obviously the big thing. I talked to one person who's running for statewide office the other day who said, look, everyone I talk to knows who Joe Ganim is. They understand that Joe Ganim has had this in his past. Do you think that Democratic primary voters are really clued into the fact that Joe Ganim went to prison for 7 years for corruption?
It was such a public meltdown, Ganim's career in Bridgeport, and that, you know, most people around the state, I think, know about it. This is such an interesting storyline of a Greenwich businessman versus, you know, this ex-con from out of Bridgeport who's on this road to redemption. And so it's a great sort of storyline. I can't imagine that the leadership of the Democratic Party would want Ganim to win this thing. I think Republicans would love it and that they would bring Ganim's history up. And that would be front and center, would be the major focus of the campaign. And so in many ways, it could be a disaster. What will be interesting to see, though, is whether Lamont can create enthusiasm in many of these cities in a way and connect with voters in a way that I think Ganim will connect with. His experiences, his background are things that people in many central cities can connect with. And so from that standpoint, Lamont's got some work to do to make that connection with voters in urban communities, because he just can't win this thing without massive turnout from the cities.
And Bilal, I just want to follow up on that a little bit, because, and this isn't a knock on Ned Lamont. Mm-hmm. From everything I understand, he's been going around the state. He's been meeting with a lot of people trying to make inroads into cities. And the fact that he has support of labor, the fact that he has support of the Democratic Party establishment is helping him. But I will say that watching Joe Ganim at work, he does make pretty strong connections within many in the African-American community, mm-hmm. within the city. And he's not running with Eva Bermudez Zimmerman as a lieutenant governor candidate, but he kind of is. He's sort of attracting some of the same folks who are fed up with the Democratic Party establishment. And there is an energy around that that is undeniable. Whether or not it goes anywhere, it is undeniable.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think, again, this is a real challenge for Ned Lamont. I think Ganim has a story that really resonates and connects with people in central cities. Many folks who have themselves felony convictions or have relatives with felony convictions, people who want a second chance, an opportunity to reintegrate in society and to contribute to society. And in many ways, his story represents that. And that's a story that will resonate with people ultimately, whether that is a story that will resonate outside of those central cities, I think is the real challenge for him.
Of course, Ned Lamont, Max making the case, is not a second chance. It's a third chance. You had your second chance. Go run Bridgeport.
06, 10, 2018? That's what. Are you referring to Joe or Ned? I lost track.
I'm referring to Joe in that way. Ned John. Lamont has had a few chances, but that's his right. So he can go back and run for anything he wants.
I spoke to a very well-placed Democratic source. This was 2 weeks ago we met, and he said to me in the same breath two things. He goes, number one, Ned Lamont isn't going to get any enthusiasm from the cities. In the same breath, he said, but Joe Ganim isn't going to get any votes outside the cities. He said those higher information voters in your areas around New Haven, areas around Hartford, areas around Bridgeport, the high information Democratic voters, they're just not going to vote for Joe Ganim because of his past. Ned Lamont, from that debate last week, we saw Ned Lamont, which I frankly did not expect to see. He's kind of to use a Donald Trump phrase, he is a kind of a low energy candidate. He doesn't rile up easily, but he came off forceful. He came off assertive, something we didn't expect to see. But I don't know if that connects very well, because also Joe Ganim is running a really good campaign, whether you like him or not. He's sending out emails all the time. Now he's making an issue of Ned Lamont's country club membership, from years ago. I'm telling you, man, that's good research. Whether it's good politics or not, I don't know, but it's good research.
Well, I will say, Susan, I'll talk just briefly, because there wasn't a ton of substance in this debate that I moderated the other night on climate change and other environmental issues. Certainly substance on very important issues, but there wasn't a lot to differentiate the candidates. We had the two Democrats. We had a Libertarian candidate, and we also had Oz Griebel there. But to Max's earlier point, I will say that the somewhat low-energy Ned that shows up when he walks around was not so low-energy. He understood how to, when you have a crowd of 100 people or so, get them a little bit riled up. He understands how to talk directly to Democratic voters in a way that Joe Ganim doesn't seem to be able to do from the stump or maybe from the lectern in a debate setting.
Right. Ganim is very good at retail politics. He's good at walking around, talking to people, listening. A lot of what you hear about people who meet Ganim on the street is that they feel like he's listening to them. And that's a really powerful thing. But no, Ganim does not look great when he's debating, and he doesn't look great when he's giving a speech. But it's that retail politics aspect that could make a real difference in a primary, especially in the cities, especially if Ned Lamont is struggling to connect with people. I think that Ned has realized that there is a danger from Joe Ganim and that this is not necessarily going to be an easy primary. So he's trying to be more forceful. Where that's going to go for him, I don't know. But I do think he realizes that there is a danger here.
There's a very dangerous narrative that could emerge from the Democratic primary. Number one, Ned Lamont, he's self-funding. He's using his own money for this. He does not want to spend multiple millions of dollars on a primary run. He just doesn't want to do it. It's unclear if that's going to happen, but Ned Lamont is up on television. We'll see how long that goes for. But number two, if Joe Ganim is going to run this credible campaign, which it looks like he is, how tight the margin is between him and Ned Lamont, assuming Ganim loses, could dictate part of the narrative in the fall, where if Ned Lamont only wins 55-45 or even closer than that, that could be a big problem, where the Republicans can say, do you really want to back a party that is wanted to put a convicted felon back in office?
Right.
Do you really want to back that? And that could be a strong argument, to Bilal's point earlier, all politics being local. That's where the Joe Ganim could really become a factor in the race.
And I think the real problem, though, that Ganim has is that because this is a primary in August, turnout really favors Lamont in terms of the kind of voter who shows up during these primaries. And so even though the enthusiasm in cities may be potentially on Ganim's side, the reality is, if you're talking about who actually shows up at the polls in August for a primary, it really favors Lamont. And so I'm not sure how close this will actually be. But I think from a structural standpoint, Ganim has some real challenges ahead of him turning out people who support him. And so this retail politics idea that, that Susan is pointing out is really important, because he's got to get out into those communities and not just the urban areas to turn out people.
It is worth pointing out that when Ned Lamont won in 2006 in that primary, it was votes in the cities that carried him through. So it can be done. Votes in the cities in a primary in August can make a difference.
Yeah. I just want to say, apropos of this this forum that I moderated on climate change and other environmental issues, interesting, Bilal, because of the mix of candidates on stage, there wasn't a whole lot of differentiation on any important topics. It was, though, fascinating to talk about those issues at the statewide level because they so rarely make their way into the larger conversation. I think it gets back to some of those divides that we have in politics right now, which is if you're talking about a Senate race or you're talking about the presidency, there's a wide range of things we might talk about having to do with federal tax policy, you know, how we deal with Russia and other international issues and climate change. And at the local level, it's much different. But the idea that we might be able to broaden what we talk about right. and what we ask about when we see the candidates in person or when we moderate a debate, I think that there's some value in that and actually getting these people to talk about anything other than just their talking points.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This is, you know, certainly one of the most important issues that we face as a civilization, not just as Connecticut voters, but as a civilization. And so I think part of the challenge is really for many of us, particularly the science around climate change is really difficult for a lot of people to really wrap their minds around. There's also a lot of people out there who are pushing a false narrative about, you know, that climate change is not real and that, you know, or these are things that, you know, we technologically we could come up with some quick fixes somewhere in the future. And, you know, the real worry is that, of course, we live on this planet and it's the only planet we have access to right now. And so, you know, we've got to figure out how to turn this around and we've got to get politicians talking more about it and we've got to have a conversation as a society about the things that we can do to prevent this, you know, calamity from, you know, hitting us.
And the reason I bring it up, Susan, and again, not just because we had a debate this past week and candidates were somewhat forced to talk about it, but there is this interesting divide. When we talk about a governor's race, it's all about, okay, what are you going to do to solve the problem with the budget and what are you going to do for my pocketbook and my schools? And the conversation ends there. And I guess I just wonder how you feel voters think about the job of governor in the context of this larger life that we live in terms of whether or not it's the climate or the arts or how good our state parks are, all these things that aren't just about how are you going to solve the budget problem.
No, and for the past 10 years or so, everything has been about the economy, budget, et cetera. But the governor can be a cheerleader for a lot of different things, including the environment, including the arts. Getting back to the idea that all politics is local, though, I do feel like there is a narrative you can craft around, well, climate change is hitting your local area. Have you noticed the storms are getting more and more intense and they're just going to get stronger still? And so your town needs to be prepared somehow. Can the governor help you with that? And that's an important thing.
I think just looking at what Dan Malloy has tried to do in some of these areas, and I would even take it out a couple of steps further. You know, he's tried to do things on transportation. He's tried to do things on criminal justice. He has done things on both of those, but he's also tried to do things on climate change, had summits with other governors and things like that. Well, it doesn't matter. The only thing anybody talks about is the economy. And I think part of that, too, is to Susan's point, it's also what regular people are talking about. But the one thing I will say, though, too, about this General Assembly is I think that the environment and some of these things, that it has been top of mind. They have passed environmental bills. They have passed energy-specific issues in the General Assembly on a bipartisan basis. So I think that there is a consensus that the issue of climate change, by and large, of course there are individual exceptions. But do I think that Martin Looney, Bob Duff, Themis Claridis, and Len Fasano are in the ballpark when it comes to these things? Absolutely. And I think that that will rub off on whoever the governor is.
Go ahead, Bilal, quickly. Yeah.
But I think one of the challenges, though, is that there is this disconnect from what the population understands and believes we need to do as a society to address this problem and what politicians may be doing because, say, special interests or lobbyists are sort of trying to impact. And while I'm a strong believer in the need of civic education to sort of help with dealing with some of our problems around political participation and knowledge of how our political system works, we need something quite comparable to that in the area of what effect human beings are having on this planet and on its climate, that people's literacy and understanding of that issue just needs to rise to a level much higher than what it is right now.
And I will just say quickly that the one differentiator that I maybe heard on stage, Oz Griebel, was, while certainly very concerned about all of the issues of climate change and what the state could do, he continually brought it back to the fact that we can't really do anything unless we solve some of the underlying fiscal problems that we have at the state level. It's really hard to say we want to meet climate goals for 2050 of being renewable if we can't even balance the budget this particular year. Before we break, I just want to get to John in Kensington, who's calling about something we just talked about. Hey, John, go ahead.
I was going to say that I think that an August primary favors the turnout in cities, so I may have the edge for that. It's the little pockets of affinity groups. Maybe unions are more excited. I don't think anybody's going to rush to the a primary because of global warming. The inner cities where the voter ID is going to be more sophisticated, the get out the vote's going to be greater, is going to move more people to the polls than trying to get someone from Simsbury to lead the soccer game to go to vote. I don't know whether or not Ganim's going to win, but I think I would rather concentrate. You know, it's almost like Trump did, you know, worry about the Electoral College and not the popular vote. I think if you concentrate on the cities, you're going to have a winning recipe.
John, I really appreciate your phone call, and it's really interesting analysis. I mean, I think the one thing that you're going on, Bilal, when you talk about that is, I mean, turnout in primaries in cities historically is shockingly low. I mean, if you talk about, you know, a special election for a Hartford City Council seat, I mean, my goodness, it's in the hundreds of people.
Right.
And so the idea that you're going to get big turnout in cities maybe isn't there. John's point is, if anyone's going to get enthusiastic, if anyone's going to get mobilized, maybe it is the unions, maybe it is the cities, right, as opposed to people in Simsbury. I don't know, I might be at the Cape. I don't know. Do I really need to vote?
I think certainly for the general election, that will be a key strategy to use. You know, you're going to need that turnout. Democrats just can't win without massive turnout from the central cities. I think part of the challenge is that when we think about who your typical voter is, they tend to be older, they tend to be well-educated, have higher levels of income. And they are paying attention to what's going on in a way that you know that many voters are not paying attention to at this point of the game. And so it'll be interesting to see what actually happens if, you know, voter sort of participation research is any indicator of it. It's the people who have higher levels of education and income who are the ones who are much more likely to turn out.
We're going to talk a bit more about money in the race and also a bit about the Connecticut 5th Congressional District seat, which we haven't talked about yet today, with Bilal Sakhu from the University of Hartford, Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com. We're on CTN today. Colin McEnroe isn't here, but we've got a great panel talking about the news of the week on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Bilal Sakhu, who is an associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and also Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. I will once again just refer you to the WNPR.org page for where he lives. You can see some of the candidates who are coming up in the next couple of weeks. We're going to be hearing from a lot of the people that we're talking about. 4 years ago, when Governor Malloy was seeking re-election, he managed to bring in a lot of money to the state Democratic Party, often from out-of-state sources. He was chair of the Democratic Governors Association. After all, well, our friend and campaign finance tracker extraordinaire Mark Pazniokas at the Mirror reported this week that without Malloy, state Democratic Party coffers are down dramatically. So I don't know, Bilal, this is interesting. Everyone wants to run away from Governor Malloy and his bad record on the economy and how we're in this deep hole and nobody wants to be seen next to, you know, one of the least popular governors in America. But when it comes to making money for the party, seems like the guy did a pretty darn good job.
You know, reading Mark's article, I was just amazed at the way in which Malloy was able to raise money for the party and to do things even on a national level, not alone just for the state. And so when I read the article, I tried to picture Ned Lamont being that person who would be out asking for money. And it just the image of him doing that as someone who's self-funding his campaign just struck me as that's going to be difficult for him to do.
But it also struck me, too. It gets back to some of our previous conversation, which is nationally, Governor Malloy is viewed very differently than he
exactly.
is here at the state level. Nationally, he is viewed, Max, as someone who is a leader on climate change and working with other states. Nationally, he's seen as someone who is amongst the strongest voices when it comes to gun control measures that Democrats overwhelmingly favor. And he's been very willing to speak out as the attack dog against Republicans who want to go after some of the core things that the Democratic Party believes in. In that way, you know, at the national level, he's a superstar. Locally, they think he's kind of a chump.
I think Bilal makes a good comparison there. I mean, Dan Malloy is on the MSNBC Rolodex, right? Like, if there's an issue that they think he can maybe opine on, they call him up, and then frankly, he heads on over to 1422 New Britain Avenue and does a live shot with us at NBC Connecticut. But nationally, he still has that pedigree. You know, this is a guy who would headline fundraisers for Democratic groups in Oklahoma and in Florida, I think Arizona as well, and other events around the country. I mean, he's still the chair of the DGA, like all these big things. It's very hard to see Ned Lamont serving that role. And it's not surprising that the bench is maybe a little bit thin right now when it comes to people who can actually raise money for statewide Democrats.
Plus, Democratic priorities are different than they were in 2014. Right now, Democratic money is going elsewhere. It's going to the swing states. It's going to swing districts. It's going to national party stuff. It's not necessarily being focused at the state level right now. So while Democrats nationally are pulling in some decent money, right now, state Democrats don't really have the same kind of following.
A quick thought?
Yeah, the thing I would add, though, is that the one benefit Democrats have in this state, though, is a lot more people will give smaller amounts than Republicans will, just because there's more registered Ds. That's the one, I guess, silver lining for some Ds.
Flipping it to the Republican side, in a need for money, you talk with Erin Stewart, running for lieutenant governor this week, hopeful she could raise the final $15,000 she needs to qualify for public financing. It's been a little bit of a rough go for Erin Stewart.
Her run for governor was as ill-conceived from the beginning. She won't say that out loud, but she started way too late. She should have started the day after she won a re-election in New Britain. Instead, she waited till January, February, didn't have enough time to raise enough money for governor to make a credible run. And now she's having the same problem with lieutenant governor. You got to go back to a lot of the same people and try to get that money again. The good thing about Erin Stewart is we're talking about retail politics. She might be the best retail politics person on the Republican side. She very well might be. That will help. But if she doesn't get this $400,000 grant, she could be in very big trouble compared to her counterparts, Joe Markley and Jamie Stevenson.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, some of the best retail politic people who are in these races are people who represent urban, blue-collar, you know, racially and ethnically mixed kinds of cities. And so that might, in fact, be a statement about the kind of work that they've got to do in the case of Gannon and also Stewart. I mean, they are working in cities that have large populations of people of color, and so they've had to go out there and meet with people. And these are not the best sort of fundraising basis to pick from also for many of these cities. And so I think, more power to her if she's able to do it. I'm a big champion of our public financing system. I'm the chair of the board for Common Cause in Connecticut, and we have been strong backers of that from the very start and helped to bring that law into being. I've never had the concern about too many candidates trying to do this because I think it encourages the kind of retail politics that we're celebrating at this table. And so this is something that's very good for our system.
Quick thought, Susan?
I think that this really does hurt Erin Stewart, who was seen as a rising star in the Republican Party before she decided to run for governor. Right now, she's looking a lot weaker, and she may come out of this with absolutely nothing.
Yeah, so some Republicans have said she got into the first race too late. She jumped into the second race a little too early. But she's young. She can get back into this. Hey, we just have a little bit of time, Max, left. I want to ask about the 5th Congressional District race. Democrats Mary Glassman and Johanna Hayes are both well in the lead when it comes to fundraising over the three GOP primary candidates. I mean, should we be looking at this as a race in the primary between Mary Glassman and Johanna Hayes that's really going to determine who ends up taking that 5th district seat?
When Elizabeth Esty announced she was going to run for your election, we all thought this was going to be competitive. The Republicans could not get their act together with putting together candidates that can win, that can raise a lot of money, between $3 and $5 million to put on a credible race, a ton of TV ads, a ton of digital buys. We're just not seeing that from Rich DuPont or Ruby O'Neill or Manny Santos. We're just not. The primary is likely going to be what determines. Johanna Hayes is the insurgent candidate. Over 5.5 million views now. It's pretty remarkable what she's done in just a short period of time.
A quick thought on this, Bilal?
What's amazing to me is that I think this is a race that is drawing a lot of national attention, and so we're going to see a lot of dollars from outside of the state come in. And I think particularly if she, Johanna, is able to win, this is really an historic election in the state as well, and will draw a lot of attention because of that.
We've run out of time. Bilal Sakhu from the University of Hartford, thank you so much. Thanks also to Max Reese from NBC Connecticut and our friend Susan Bigelow, as always, from CTNewsJunkie.com. Thanks to everyone who produces The Whale House, our executive producer, Katie Talarski, our producer, Scott Breedy, Kion Wolf, our technical producer, our summer intern, Zandra Ellen, who helped out with the show. Carlos Mejia is the one to thank for all of our stuff on the web. And thanks to CTN as well.